WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. When someone in publishing asked just how big a book, Presumed Innocent, The Murder Mystery by Scott Turow, would be, the insider responded, referring to the publicity campaign, "Big, very big. We're talking bus cards, those posters on the sides of buses. And about 4 million copies of the book have been sold. And hot books are hot Hollywood properties. And the film made from the book is now out, directed by my guest today, Alan Pakula. Adapting well-known books for the screen is familiar work for Pakula. He produced To Kill a Mockingbird and Up the Down Staircase. The first movie he directed was The Sterile Cuckoo, and subsequently directed from an original screenplay, the thriller Clute. He won an Academy Award nomination for his direction of All the President's Men, and another for his adaptation of William Styron's Sophie's Choice, that he also directed. He just directed Presumed Innocent. Harrison Ford portrays Rusty Sabich, a prosecuting attorney accused of murdering his former mistress and colleague. Bonnie Bedelia portrays his wife, and Raul Julia, his defense attorney. It's part investigation, part courtroom drama. It's a suspense story many have read, and a story some are waiting to read before they then see the movie. I ask Alan Pakula, was it the script treatment or the book that attracted him to Presumed Innocent?
Both, actually. I read the book and was interested in doing a film, and the first draft screenplay was sent to me by Sidney Pollack and Mark Rosenberg, who were the producers. And I read the first draft screenplay and I saw how difficult it was to adapt this into a film. It's a story told in the first person, and there's nothing quite comparable, literally comparable, in film as there is to telling first person in a book. So we really spent, from the time I said I would do it, we spent about a year on the script, Frank Pearson and I, and it just needed all that time. If you're doing a suspense film, it is very important the audience have certain facts, so they always know where they're at. So they know what to hope for or what to be afraid of. That's where the excitement comes from. That's where the suspense comes from. If the audience has no set of facts that they can relate to, then there's no suspense. And you have to have this feeling of, oh, this could happen or this can happen. Which one will happen? That's suspense. If you don't have enough set of facts to say, to have that, to ask those questions, then you just sort of go along staring at the story, but there is not that kind of excitement. And with a story this complicated, with this many characters, this kind of character study, whodunit, you're always juggling these characters, making sure that the audience doesn't have too many names that they have to follow, too many clues they have to follow at once. Harrison Ford and I kept asking questions of each other every second. We would test each other by saying, all right, what do you know now about the story? Tell me, as the audience, where are you? What information do you have and what don't you have? We would keep checking.
There's a need in the course of one of these stories to place clues, facts or clues, as you go along. And how did you decide to weight certain clues versus others? Did you want the audience to try to figure out the story?
I wanted the audience to feel they were always on the verge of figuring out the story, that they were about to do it and then be teased along that much farther and given another clue that might throw them off the track. There have been several films this summer that have been physical roller coaster rides. This one is really a mental roller coaster ride, in a sense, in that you are taken in one direction and then suddenly another clue takes you in another direction. And that's the fascination of this kind of thing. At the same time, unlike the ordinary melodrama story, or in the average melodrama story, Scott Turow wrote very complicated, rich characters. And you then have to stop to really develop those characters at the same time. Hitchcock once said, one of the most difficult things to do is to do character studies and suspense at the same time because the rhythms are different. So you're always balancing those rhythms. How long can you stop for character? You really can never let that story go. The great gift that Scott gave us was this extraordinary plot. At the same time, that plot became our master. We always had to serve it. In an ordinary film, you can, be more leisurely and start exploring character for its own sake. Here, character always had to be revealed within the context of the plot being revealed.
You were quite loyal to many details in the book, not only the course of action, but the even the kinds of clothes that people wore, the color of the hair of the characters.
The difficulty of doing an adaptation of a best-selling book is that you have about, well, in this case, with about 4 million copies of the book was sold, you have millions and millions of other picture makers, because everybody who reads a book is a picture maker. He has pictures of what those characters look like, what those locales look like, and now you come in with the arrogance of the filmmaker and say, yeah, but this is what it really looked like. And it better, in some ways, correspond to what the author's intent was, if you're going to capture the audience in that way.
Your lead, Harrison Ford, who played Rusty Savage, is a guy I associate with a fedora, a whip, or a ray gun. And here he played a very closed-in, repressed character. What did you have to do with him to get him to play this much more sort of quiet, passive, reactive rather than active role?
Actually, he's not a passive character. Indeed, events seem to take him over in many ways, but I wouldn't say that he's passive. He's a passionate prosecuting attorney when the story opens. He's a man of deep emotions. As a matter of fact, what I find interesting about the character is that it is a very active man who finds himself in a very passive position. The prosecutor is very active, and suddenly he finds himself on trial for murder, where you really are in a passive position. At the same time, he does, even during that period, have efforts in trying to deal with the case. It's a very difficult thing to ask an actor to do, especially a man who's played Indiana Jones. And the time when you work on that is even before he's decided to do it. I went out to Harrison's ranch in Wyoming when we had a script, and we spent several days together. We read through the script, because while Harrison was interested, he was concerned about playing this role for the very reasons you pointed out. And I read all the other characters, and he read Rusty Savage's character. I read all the other characters badly, I might add, and I was surprised that he could even sound at all real, considering he was playing these scenes over a kitchen table with me. But during that time, we would stop and start, and you would find and discuss all of the active things going on in this character, even though he may not be revealing them on, obviously, in dialogue. And during that time, we really found the arc of the character, the growth of the character, all of the things that might not be revealed in an immediate reading of the script, where so many of the other characters have so much more bravura dialogue, for example, than his character has. It was once, I think, Harrison saw how rich the character was in an interior way that he could, one, commit himself to do the film, and then allow himself to give such a controlled performance. The difficulty in playing that kind of character is you can't cheat. If you're playing a man who's has a deep feeling but can't, but has a difficult time revealing it, he better darn well have be feeling that deep feeling, so that that audience has some sense that something is going on underneath. Otherwise, it'll be totally empty.
There's been a lot of comment about Harrison Ford's haircut in the production, and I'm wondering if this is this is one aspect that you tried to set up to set him apart from his previous sort of hero roles.
You brought up something which is a perfect example of how nobody knows who does what on a film.
Uh-huh.
Some critics, it amuses me, will say, well, the director did this, and this actor did this, and the writer did this, and the cameraman did this. And very often at the end of a film, nobody remembers what they did. when it works, it's a synthesis. But in the case of Harrison's haircut, I do know, because it became a kind of mini conflict. Harrison called me on the phone from Wyoming one day, all excited, and said, I've got my hair cut. And I said, what? He said, I'm going to have a very short haircut. And there was a very long pause on the other end of the phone from me. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, I am playing this Midwestern man, and you say you would like him to be an ordinary man, and you don't want him to look like a movie star, and you'd like him to be like the man down the block. And And I said, Harrison, all of that is true. At the same time, we hired Harrison Ford, who was a film star, and I would be deeply concerned if you come out of this as a fairly unrecognizable character actor. There can be truth in that performance, but at the same time, we can recognize who the actor is who's playing the role. He said, no, 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 you're going to love it. And I said, I'm not sure of this. He said, look, I'll come to New York and you look at the haircut. He came to New York and I looked at the haircut. Never has there been so much discussion over how the length of somebody's hair in a film. Certainly not a man's. And he came in the office and I was disturbed because he looked so different. By the time he left the office, I realized not only was it right for the film, but it's one of those things that was a great help to him. He was no longer Indiana Jones. He was no longer Harrison Ford to himself. He was nobody but the character of Rusty Savage.
My guest is film director Alan Pakula. He directed Presumed Innocent, the new film based on Scott Turow's novel, which stars Harrison Ford. When you were making All the President's Men, you reconstructed a Washington Post newsroom down to having Washington Post memos in the trash can, details like that. Did you end up reconstructing sets of courtrooms and prosecuting attorneys' offices for Presumed Innocent as well?
Yes, well, I had the same production designer, George Jenkins, who was an absolute stickler for reality. And we were looking for places in the Midwest to shoot the film, and we found a courtroom in Cleveland. It's a federal courtroom, and we both became very enthusiastic about it. And it had the dignity and the majesty of the whole concept of law. And part of the tension of this story, of this film, is the contrast between the ideal of justice and the flawed manner in which justice is executed. We toyed with the idea, actually, of shooting in that courtroom, and it became just impractical. And indeed, it became the basis. It is not exactly that courtroom, but I would say that there's a 75 to 80% similarity. We even got a copy of the mural that hung in the courtroom to use in our film.
You shot much of the, or some of the movie in Detroit, which is a very tough city with a tiny core and lots of blank and burnt out neighborhoods. Did you have to like work around those geographical restrictions in Detroit?
No, quite the opposite. I really wanted all the contrast one could get for the city. The story in the book takes place in, I think, a mid-sized Midwestern city. I remember when I went to talk to Scott Turow the first time, the writer of the book, and I said, tell me, Scott, a lot of people think this took place in Chicago, although it seemed to me you indicated a smaller city than that. And he said, well, yes, it was smaller. And I said, well, for example, when I asked him where one courtroom was, he said, oh, that was in Boston where I worked. And I said, and I asked him another courtroom. He said, oh, that was in Chicago where I was also worked in the prosecutor's office. And I said, and what about the ferry that takes him from his house to the city in which he works? He said, oh, that's Oakland, San Francisco, where I taught at one time. And I said, thanks a lot, Scott. I mean, you have a total composite and pastiche. So we had to recreate this composite city. I was fascinated by Detroit because it has all the high contrasts of a modern American city today. But, for example, the magic of movies is that this man starts out, when I say this is a composite, he starts out from a house that we shot in Allendale, New Jersey. His wife drives him in a car and drops a child off at school, at a school in Allendale, New Jersey. She then drives him down to the ferry, which is in Windsor, Canada, across the river from river from Detroit. He then gets on a boat that takes him to Detroit. He then climbs up the steps of an exterior of a building where he works, and that building is in New York. He walks into the interior lobby, and that is the City Hall of Newark, New Jersey. Then he goes upstairs, and he walks into his offices, and that's set in Astoria, Long Island. And out of all of those different places, halfway around the country, comes one place. That is the magic of movies.
Did you ever get confused in the shot sequence?
Well, no, you plan that out. The amazing thing is that even though you've been through it and you've shot all this, when you run the film for yourself, when you're cutting it, you just never think about the fact that it took place in all those places. It just seems as natural to you as it does to an ordinary audience. It's all in one place. That's extraordinary hypnotic quality that brings everything together in film.
You've produced and directed many great films over the years, many of them from books, including To Kill a Mockingbird, Up the Down Staircase, Sophie's Choice, All the President's Men, Presumed Innocent. What is it about books that attracts you as a director, say, to screenplays?
Well, it's, by the way, I mean, I also do things like Clute that are from original screenplays.
Right, well.
I just want you to think that I'm a purist about only doing books. However, there is a great attraction in books, and that is all the extraordinary texture, the world you have to draw upon in a really good novel. There is so much background texture, subtext, you might call it. It'll be subtext in a film anyway, that gives that sense of reality and richness that you have to draw upon that is sometimes more difficult to get in an original screenplay. I sometimes think that too often the average screenwriter will spend too short a time doing a screenplay, maybe weeks or months. This is not always the case, but in many cases. And a good novelist is very often spent years in developing that world and developing those characters. And that time very often has paid off in giving you just a much richer world to work with. I'm not saying, by the way, that a genius or somebody like Preston Sturges can't write a great movie in a week or two, because there are cases of that. But by and large, having that kind of background world that the novel gives you to inform a film can be very helpful indeed. Now, that has other problems. I mean, you're taking something that was designed to function in one way and asking it to function in another way. And there are many novels, I would say, that by their very nature are almost impossible to do as films.
How did you first learn to read a screenplay?
How did I learn to read a screenplay? Nobody's asked me that. I learned to read a screenplay when I had my first job at MGM. I was in love with the theater. I was a theater director when I got out of Yale. And I was 20 and at that age thought I knew a good deal more than I did, as it turned out. And it never occurred to me I had to learn how to read a screenplay. I got my first job at MGM and I was reading screenplays and making a lot of, I think, unfair, arrogant judgments, and I think in making those judgments found out a good deal about what worked and what didn't work. I remember being at Paramount, and I was about 21, 22, and reading a screenplay of Rear Window and thinking, well, it's all very pleasant, but I don't really get the suspense in this. You know, I'm strange that Hitchcock is doing this film when it doesn't seem to have very much suspense. Well,
that must have startled you when you saw the film.
Well, when I began seeing dailies, I began learning a great deal of humility, because the difference between what is on the written page and what a director may have in mind can be extraordinary. And while it was a perfectly craftsmanlike screenplay, the vision that Hitchcock had that informed that film was extraordinary. And I sometimes think that even today that people who make the decisions about what films should be made and should not be made don't know how to read a screenplay. Very often we'll skim over because they read so many scripts. They'll take home 10 or 15 scripts to read over a weekend because they have all these decisions to make. And I think when you read that way, there's a tendency to kind of read through the dialogue, you know, and that can be a very bad way to read a screenplay, because that's not how the film's going to look. I also think that people, this is my advice to executives today, I think, should really not judge a screenplay until, if there was a director involved, make a final judgment, until they've discussed the screenplay with the director and seen see exactly what he has in mind and how much that vision is reflected by the screenplay. But those two things should go together in making the final decision.
There's a scene in Clute, which was from an original screenplay, where Jane Fonda sings a hymn, and I understand this was actually not part of the screenplay. I wonder how her, a call girl in the movie, began to sing this hymn and how it became included in the movie.
Well, that's a wonderful thing about working with actors. I always say to actors, however much we rehearse, and I believe in rehearsing, nothing pleases me more than surprises. What happens in the moment, what comes out of your own behavior. In Clute, again, we had the problem of a melodrama that was really a character study, and the two rhythms. I mean, how much time could you take to explore character? So we didn't, while she was this complicated call girl, we didn't reveal a great deal about her background. And we looked for ways to do that. And here she's this call, it was a scene at the very early part of the picture, and she's just picked up a trick and just had the trick, and now she's home in her apartment alone, and she's smoking pot at that point, and sitting there and relaxing. And at that moment, I was also trying to dramatize it. In some ways, that trick for her was a fix, not a sexual fix. Somewhere or other, it was a release of some kind of compulsive tensions. And for that moment, there was a moment of peace. And she's sitting in her apartment alone, smoking that pot. And I didn't say to Jane, do a hymn. I just said, you know that character well enough. We've rehearsed this thing long enough. Let's see what you feel like. And she sat there, and she started to hum in this pot-like trance that this character's in. And there was this hymn that most of us have all learned at Thanksgiving as children in school. And suddenly you could see this character in some small town somewhere, having been an ordinary little child or with some kind of upbringing we could all relate to. That just came out of Jane, just as Jane insisted on having health food in the refrigerator in that apartment. And it, again, created a fascinating tension of a girl who does this most self-destructive kind of behavior, being a prostitute, and then goes home and stocks her refrigerator full of health food and makes herself all sorts of health food mixes. That's the kind of work I ask from actors. We sometimes try to create together, and I also encourage them to do it for themselves.
Your director of photography for Presumed Innocent, Gordon Willis, also worked with you on All the President's Men and on Clute. Each has its own distinctive visual style.
Well, he worked with me on Clute, on Parallax View. Yes, All the President's Men, and the last picture we'd done before Presumed Innocent was a Western with Jane Fonda called Comes a Horseman. All very different, and of course he's done the Godfather films, just done Godfather 3, which is again another very different style, and did so many films of Woody Allen, as a matter of fact. I think the visual style of Woody Allen began when Gordon Willis started working with him. Gordon worked with me on Clute. It was the second picture I'd ever done as a director, and I was still unsure of my visual ideas. I had strong feelings, and I wasn't sure how much I should trust them. And Gordon was the one who said, trust them. He's a remarkable, remarkable craftsman. He's a great artist, and he does not just make pretty pictures. He thinks conceptually. One of the wonderful things with Gordon is when you have your first meeting with him, and you say, this is my visual concept of this film. And 6 months later, when you're two-thirds of the way through production and everybody's tired and most people are fighting the flu, which invariably happens on films, he will remind you when you're trying to compromise, that was not your visual conception of the film, Al. So he's not only just a wonderful tool for a director, he's also a superb collaborator.
Well, Alan Pakula, I want to thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you very much.
My guest today, film director Alan Pakula. His new film is Presumed Innocent. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.